At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Clint H. from Santa Monica, California.
Thank you. My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. Delighted to be at the 10th Annual Unity Day up here in Auburn. I'm kind of familiar with this area. I used to have a little piece of property on the south fork of the American at something they call Barking Dog Rapids. Ooh. Named after me when I was drinking nowadays. So it's good to be here. Good to be back up in this area again. I enjoy this area a lot. And I've enjoyed being with you this evening. And I want to thank Ben for including me. And it's so wonderful to see Howard. And I know that if you were here at noon when he spoke, you were very glad to be part of that. Ross picked me up at the airport. It's always a colorful experience. Because it's funny. Let me just tell you. A few years ago, I called into the office for messages, and the receptionist said, "Well, you certainly lead an interesting life." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I do. What are you looking at?" And she said, "Well, I'm just reading a message here from somebody that from Indianapolis that called." I said, "Oh." She said, "I didn't know you were going to be in Indianapolis this weekend." I said, "Yeah. What does the message say?" And she said, "Well, it says that a guy named Ron is going to pick you up at the airport. And you'll know who he is because he has a wooden leg and he'll be carrying a big book." And sure enough, I got off that airplane and there was Ron, and he had a big book under his arm and a wooden leg. He'd been nice guy. He'd been a Hell's Angel. He lost that leg in a motorcycle deal, and it was raining that night over there. And he said he's parked down in the parking lot. He had a Pinto. I was glad we weren't going to get on the back of him. Funny guy. We got to be pretty good friends that weekend. He had an earring in his ear. I kidded him some. I said that the Ohio State Wildlife Commission had caught him sleeping in the park and tagged his ear and sent his ass to AA. He was took me back to the airport on Sunday morning, and he had a gift for me in a little brown bag. And I looked in it, and it was his. It's a funny thing, you know. You open up a bag. It was just he and I got along real well, and in that bag was his first wooden foot. And he was kind of a lot of things go through your mind at a moment like that. Love you like a rainbow, Ron, but I cannot take this through that. I don't even want to try through that metal detector with this thing. So he hung on to it, but I talked to him. So when I recognized a friend at the airport today, I was very pleased. It was Nan Ross has been terrific. So I'm very glad to be here, and I'm very glad to welcome the people that are new or sort of new. I saw 9 people stand up that had under 30 days, and I'm so glad you're here. There is, I'm going to tell you something very interesting. With all of the sobriety that's in the room, you might think if you're new and look around here that these people have some capacity that you don't have, and because they're not drinking, you might think that they can quit drinking. And you might have already discovered that you can't quit. And none of us quit. We're not drinking anymore, but not one of us quit. Not in the sense that you would quit. The people, you know where the people are that quit? They're home tonight. They quit. They just got a little bored with it and they quit. Is that amazing? You know who's here tonight? The people that can't quit. I mean, we talk like we quit and all that stuff. I don't think so. There was a guy named Chuck who Howard and I knew and enjoyed very much, and he said something that I always was interested in. He said, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. Remember? Yeah. Yeah, hey, I'm quitting, let's go. In fact, who was it that Jordan read chapter 5? If it was about quitting, he would have read step 1, quit. Come on now, knock it off. And it doesn't say that. It says step 1, you got to get that you are toast, is what it says. And it's in that state that we come here. Firm resolve does not work for us. It just doesn't work. You got to laugh when you go through that chapter 3 thing that says more about alcoholism in the book. And it says basically, all these guys, Fred and Jim, they had all that stuff going for them. Fred was an accountant and a partner in a well-established firm and good with people and had promising children of college age or something like that and a happy married life and well-educated and a delightful human being. But he couldn't quit. Firm resolve. He made up his mind. And Jim, who is just wonderful, drank himself out of a car dealership. And he came to AA, 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 and finally, and they fished him out of the drunk tank or out of a sanitarium one more time. And they said, what happened this time, Jim? And then they repeat in chapter 3, Jim's idea of what happened this time. Jim knew that if he drank again, he'd go back to the sanitarium. They didn't have any charm schools or anything like that in those days. He just went. He knew he'd lose his wife and family for whom he had a deep affection. He knew this and that and the third thing. And so they said, knowing all that and being around AA, he drank again. How is it that that happened? And he said, well, I got to work on a Tuesday morning, which immediately raises the question, where were you Monday, Jim? If you've heard Joe and Charlie, that's kind of a night, you know. In the first, third, second, and 400th time I read this, I went, yeah, it seemed all right to me. It makes sense. That kind of insanity makes sense. That the guy would show up at work and have... He said, I was mildly irritated that I had to work for a car dealership I used to own. I'll bet you were, Jim. It's that great understatement, isn't it? I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Jim, words with the boss are always serious. Isn't that wonderful language? Decided to take a drive out into the country where I might find a prospect for a new car. That's where they are, Jim. Lying in those country roads just waiting for you. And I was hungry and I pulled into a roadhouse. We find out in a few sentences that there's also a bar in the Roadhouse. Surprise, surprise. A place he was familiar with because he'd gone there before when he was not drinking, and so he goes in there. Now it's Tuesday and it's in the middle of the day and Jim's had a rough start. And he didn't show up on Monday, and we can assume that the weekend was pretty colorful for him as well. But now he's a couple of days away from that awful weekend, and he decides as he's sitting there that he's going to have a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I can just see the self-righteousness well up in him about what a healthy... When I get home tonight, my wife is going to say, "What did you have for lunch?" And I'm going to say, "I had a sandwich and a glass of milk." And he just go, "Ooh, damn, that's just so healthy somehow." You almost get back into the big bed on a glass of milk in a story like that, right? And he had another one. Isn't that great? Now he's got down and keeping down two sandwiches and two glasses of milk. And the sense of well-being must have been almost overwhelming because now he starts to think. I mean, really think. He's been thinking, which is part of the problem so far. And he thinks if, now that he's had two sandwiches and two glasses of milk, it could not hurt at all to pour a whiskey into that milk and drink that. And he did that. And the experiment worked so well that he did it again. Man. And I'm reading this, I'm going, yeah, I understand that kind of thinking. And it doesn't frighten me that I understand that kind of thinking. That's how far gone I am. My mind, in another place in this book, says, lacks proportion and can't think straight. Which is Wilson's way of describing insanity. My mind lacks proportion and can't think straight. And it's true. I mean, did you ever drive along on the freeway and somebody pulls into your lane, and we know it's your lane? Annoying, isn't it? How about if you're a few years ago, I was in San Francisco, and I was talking to somebody that I care a lot about on the phone down in L.A., and she hung up on me. That insult is unforgivable. They have to die, don't they? I mean, it's just... no question about it. Well, do they die quickly or slowly? But they have to die. And I have those thoughts, and it's just, yeah, there we go. Astonishing to have a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. To have a mind like that, as John read tonight, leaving aside the drink question, that mind is a colorful thing. And that mind will take me back to booze, as it did Jim and Fred and the retiree. After 35 years of not drinking, he finally retires and decides he can safely drink again. More About Alcoholism is a chapter that says not so much what will happen to us if we drink, but the danger of a mind that can tell you that it's okay to drink. When I was asked a very interesting question one day, somebody said, write down the 20 craziest things you've ever done. And I went back to him with my list. And I've got a colorful list, and you have a colorful list, and we all have a colorful list. I told him about getting arrested off of that fire escape at the University of Oregon at the Tri-Delt House one night about midnight. That there was a girl in there that I had been in the same bar with me earlier in the evening, and she almost looked at me, and so I thought she wanted to talk to me. And I'm going, you know, I went to jail thinking she wanted to talk to me. That got pretty exciting. It was insane to do that. I got to dental school after a couple of false starts, and they have a clinic on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. I get drunk on Friday night, so the Saturday morning clinic is colorful at best. I got somebody sitting in a chair, and I'm supposed to show up there, and so I get trying to get over a hangover. I'll drop a bunch of spanchules of Dexamil and go on down there, which sets up a fine tremor, and they just come out with that new high-speed air-driven handpiece. And yeah, you could wipe out a quadrant of teeth just twitching. Had some very interesting experiences down there. And so I told him about those. I got thrown out of dental school, and I drank on Skid Row in Portland that next summer until I went into the service, and I came out of a blackout in a Skid Row bar one night. A place kind of like this, lit about as romantically as this room. They keep it very light because they don't want any trouble and the cops are going through. And I'm just coming out of a blackout, and I'm at a little table. And at a little round, ugly wooden table. And I'm sitting across the table from a woman that I have never met before to my memory. And I got the feeling that we were together. And traveling. Because she had all her things there. In bags. I didn't know her name. I didn't know the nature of our relationship. I had no idea how long I'd been with her. Nor where we were going. I would have asked her, but she was sleeping there at the table. She had a little chili on her cheek, so I knew we'd had dinner. Some delicate flower I'd invited to dine that night. Crazy. Crazy. And I went in the Marine Corps and I told him about getting a letter of reprimand and about having the general at El Toro invite me to resign my commission for the good of the service and to avoid a trial by court-martial. All of that stuff. And I really loved the Corps. And I really loved the uniform. And I really wanted to be a good Marine. And I couldn't pack the gear. And got into crazy trouble there. And I told him about that. And I got out of the Marine Corps, and I moved to Glendale, and I was living in an apartment for a while, and then in the car, and then in a garage. It's not a garage. A couple of years ago, my wife said, let's go by that garage. We were over in Glendale, and she said, I want to see that garage. And we went by there, and they'd torn a building down behind it, and you could see it clearly from the back street. And she said, that's not a garage. Four of us lived there, and I said, you know, you're right. She said, that's a shed. No cars ever made it in that thing. I wasn't in the shed yet. I was in the car, and I got arrested at 10 a.m. one morning for drunk driving in Glendale. I'd stopped at a light. It was red, and I'd stopped. I'd been drinking, but I stopped, and the light turned green, and amber, red, green, amber. I was resting. And a cop was right behind me. So he gets out. Gets me out of the car. Has me touching my nose. He said, that's the only shade of green we have here in Glendale. The cute cop, right? On the police report, which I saw several weeks later in a lawyer's office, he had written down, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. And I was like, wow. So I put that on the list, you know. And I want a jury trial, right?
Yeah. Not guilty.
So I go back to this guy with that stuff and other stuff on the list, and he reads my list. And he said, a lot of booze in this. And I said, yeah. He said, you get kind of crazy when you drink. I said, yeah. He said, but the craziest thing you ever did didn't make your list. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you did it repeatedly. What? And you did it before you started to drink. Every time you did it, you were doing it from a dry brain. What? With all the evidence in that you should never drink again. And before you began to drink, you decided a drink would be okay. That's crazy. That is crazy. That's insane. That's what John was reading. Leaving the drink question aside, why is living so unsatisfactory that with all the evidence in that I should never drink again, I decide to drink again? Not from having one drink and needing the second because the craving has been set up. Not from being so sick from a hangover that there's no real alternative, but from nothing. I will not give up my right to chemical peace of mind. I won't do it. That's insane. And that mind is the mind we bring in here. And so, of course, we had no capacity to quit. And we were never asked to quit. In fact, I know you quit, and I have too. I quit when I was, I don't know, maybe 6, 7 years into my drinking. 8 years. I told my wife. I told, because it felt like it was getting almost as bad as she thought it was. I told the chaplain I'm going to quit. I told the base psychiatrist at Camp Pendleton, who turned out to be a dermatologist, but I told him anyway. whatever. I told the minister in town. I told too many people. 6 weeks later, I'm drunker than I've ever been. And I quit many times after that. Living in that shed, I'd quit 3 and 4 times in the morning. This is the last half pint I'm going to need, and I'll quit. So I got to be a very good quitter, but it was so brief each time. So if you're new and you decide to quit, if you go back out there and decide to quit, don't tell anybody. Let it be your little secret. Because your mind will take you back there. It's an amazing mind to have. And we don't quite get it because the only way that I can evaluate my mind is by using my mind. Plus, I have an ego that lets me know that my mind is doing real well. And the problem is out there someplace. And as long as I think the problem's out there, I don't have an answer. I mean, we got all of this going on, this ego. Did you ever take a look at what Tebow in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age says about our ego? It says, it'll adopt a stupid position and defend it till the bitter end. Brooks no interference from man or God. I hear that. And we have these old ideas that are fascinating. They're really fascinating. I mean, I had a vague sense that I was wired up in kind of a weird way. And Howard talks about these baby elephant ideas that we have that just anchor us to some goofiness. And some years ago now, I was a friend of mine named Billy, who I really is just such a dear guy. And he had moved up to San Jose. He's an AA, and he had moved up there, and he's really great at computer stuff. And he had gotten a nice job up there, and he came back through LA, and he called me up, and he came out to the house, and we're spending the day together, basically, and we're having a lot of laughs. And he told me about a new a job that he got, an opportunity for a new job. They were going to give him a set of wheels and a staff and a raise, and he's going to go out into the territory and help the customers handle computer problems in their own facilities. And it was quite an honor, quite a compliment to him that he was getting this opportunity. And I asked him, I said, when are you going to start? And he said, oh, I can't take the job. I said, what do you mean you can't take the job? He said, well, they want me to cut my hair. I said, well, cut your hair. What do you care? He said, no, they don't have any right to make me do that. In fact, I may get another job. I said, Billy. We got on to something else, and then I said, what's the deal? I brought him back to it. I said, what's the deal about the hair? He said, and he did this whole thing again. But he finally told me, he said, you know, and I had never heard this, and he'd never told anybody to my knowledge, but he said, I can't cut my hair. I said, why? He said, I have badly deformed ears. My ears are bad. So we're talking about something else, and then I said, let me see your ears. And he loves me, and he trusts me. And he, reluctantly, but he pulled his hair back, and I looked, and it was shocking. His ears looked like my ears. Jesus. Billy, I got a news flash for you, pal. Those aren't beauties, but they're not deformed. He said, yeah, they're bad. So I got him up. We're looking at a mirror in the mirror there in the den on the wall. And he looking at his ears and leaning back and forth. And he finally said, well, they're so big. They're just huge. And so I got a ruler out of the desk, and we're comparing our ears. If you're new and you want what we have and are looking. And he finally began to get it. I said, Billy, that's an old idea. That your ears are weird. That's an old idea. Where'd that come from? Like any good alcoholic, he said, I don't know. I said, well, if you did know, what would the answer be? And he said, I don't know. I said, how does it make you feel? And he knew that. He said, it makes me feel like a clown. I said, I'll bet. And if I were you, I wouldn't cut my hair either. Because what do people do with clowns? He said, they laugh at him. I said, I know why you can't take that job. But what if it isn't true? I said, when did you first feel like a clown about that? And he remembered, and he didn't know how old he was, maybe 7. But he remembered running home from school. He remembered knowing that when he ran into the house, his mom would be there, and his mom would give him a cookie and send him out to play and then call him for dinner. And so it was a sweet time in his life. All was well. And he runs into the kitchen, and then the hit comes. The misunderstanding. His mom is on the phone, and when she sees him come in, she gets a weird look on her face. And into the phone, he hears her say, Betty, I have to hang up now. Billy just came in, and little pictures have big ears. And he never asked. And we don't ask. For whatever reason, many of us are brought up in homes where you don't ask. He just figured his ears were a huge disappointment to his mother and must therefore be deformed. It was all based on a horrible misunderstanding. And as soon as he could, he grew his hair long. And he couldn't take the job. Now, I love that story because when he told me about how it made me feel and remembered the event, he and I started laughing and crying and hollering and hooting around there. And it took him about a week, but he got his hair cut. And he went back up to San Jose and he's kicking butt up there now. So I became very interested in old ideas. I developed an old idea when I was a little kid that was to haunt me for years. I decided that my mother didn't love me. And it came out of, she said, and I was 4 years old and she and I were so tight. I adored her. And she adored me and I knew it. And she'd tuck me in and we would say our prayers and whisper our little secrets and laugh our laughter. And oh God, it was sweet. There were three kids, but I was the favorite. I don't know if I was, but I knew I was. And one day she said she was going to bring another baby home from the hospital. That's fine. Hey, knock yourself out, whatever you want to do. And she did that, and that's fine too. Until it began to be clear to me that they intended to keep that kid. And my mom spending all her... They even had a... You won't believe this. They had a room set aside for that kid. And a crib and stuff like that. And my mom's got no energy anymore for me. It's changed. And of course, I think it's changed irrevocably. And I'm very worried about this. And my answer is that kid's got to go. And I would go in there in her little crib and encourage her to move out. Give her a little thump on the head. Or whatever. My mom caught me doing that one day and she... It frightened her and she picked me up and threw me out of the room. And I knew before I hit the wall in the hall that she didn't love me anymore. I knew something else that was even more devastating, and that is that this pretense that had been going on that she did love me was a hideous betrayal. That she had never loved me. And I knew something else. I knew that I had to go it alone. And I'm not big enough for this world. I'm not big enough for this world. And I've known that since about that time. And I've known two other things right under it, and that is, I'm supposed to be big enough, and I have to keep you from finding out that I'm not big enough. And so I'm in bad shape. And I got mad at her. You know what a kid will do with that? You don't love me? Great. I don't love you. You jam it down and you try to make it that way. And you can't make it that way. But it seems safer to do that. The days went on and she and I went to war. She could make me mow the lawn, but she couldn't make me clip around the sidewalk. I took a lot of beatings because I wouldn't clip around the sidewalk. Just whipped me without end. And I wouldn't do it. It might please her because she had betrayed me. And my grandma was in the same category. And these two women seemed to me to be so cold and unloving and so judgmental. And they were people that were religious. And along came their effort to try to inculcate in me some idea of God. No way. No way. I'll go to church, but I'm not going for the deal. My uncle went down to the front one morning on a Sunday and got saved, and they sent him to China to be a missionary.
Ooh.
Stay away from the front of that church. My mom's questions were, what will you do when you meet your maker? Oh, I don't know. Apologize, I guess. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. They baptized me in the Yellowstone River early one spring. That water's about 29 degrees. I didn't find God, I'll tell you that. I didn't find much of anything for about 3 days, as I recall. Very scary to a kid. I needed a drink then. I needed Viagra then. You ever say something you kind of wish you hadn't said it? My mother found a lump in her breast when she was, after she'd had the fourth child. I was maybe 13. When I was 14, we'd moved back to Billings and we were living in the basement of my grandma's house. My grandma hated to have us come back. My dad's in Japan. My mother's very ill. Four kids now, and we lived in the cellar. And my grandma has her daughter back, and she's taking care of her upstairs, and we don't get up there. The kids are not allowed up there. My little sister was allowed up there once during that entire year, and only for a few minutes. And it was a miserable time for everybody. And I needed nothing additional to really know that you can't trust them. Now it's not just my mom. It's every woman in my life. And I am angry. And one day my grandma called down. We were in the cellar. And she called down there in the spring of 1951 and said, your mother died last night. Are you going to go to school or not? And that really kind of put the icing on the cake. And 4 days later, we're at the low-rent part of the cemetery in Billings, and they're putting my mom in that grave. And I don't cry. I don't love her. But I stop breathing deeply. And 2 years later at high school, after a football game at a party, somebody gave me some vodka. And I started breathing deeply again. And I was never going to be without that stuff. Ever. I got it that night. How come my dad drinks so much? I got it. Because that's all you can do. And it wasn't long before I knew I would... It's interesting, you know. It says it in the book that we have a capacity for faith and belief, and there are... We're born with it. We come equipped with these things. And our earliest belief for many of us is a belief in alcohol. I mean, if you look it up in the dictionary, a belief is an expectancy. And we expect something from alcohol. And we get pretty much what we expect for a while. We have faith in alcohol. A faith is a confident trust born of experience. And it doesn't take us long. I think after maybe 6 months of drinking, I had faith in alcohol. The kind of faith that makes you, if you buy a bottle and you lock it up because you can't drink it right then, and you feel better, that's faith. Or did you ever go get the prescription? It's just a prescription. And you put it in your pocket. And you feel better. Whoo! That's better. Hi, how are you? You don't even have it filled yet. But there's faith that it'll get the job done. And I had that. And I went through all of that hullabaloo. And I come to a very interesting time in my life when a bail bondsman in Glendale, California looked at me and said, I'm going to take you someplace today. And of all of the places he could have taken me, he brought me to you. Isn't that something? And he and I had done some business together. And he was kind enough to bring me to you. And the interesting thing about it was that hot July day in Glendale, California was a day that I didn't know that I was coming to you. I didn't know what would happen to me. And I was here going to meetings, not drinking for 3 weeks, and then I was drunk for two. And then I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a wonderful thing happened. There was a guy in the club in Glendale that morning about 10 o'clock on a hot, hot, miserable, hot morning. And I walked up those stairs and into the club on Central Avenue. And he looked at me and said, how you doing? I said, I'm not doing so good. He said, what happened? I said, I got drunk and let everybody down. He asked me a great question. He said, are you alcoholic? I said, yeah. Been an alcoholic about a month now. Something like that. He let that go. He didn't go after me for that. He was so sweet. He said, well, if you say you're an alcoholic and you got drunk and you think you let us down, I said, yeah. He said, no, you didn't let us down. Not if you're alcoholic. You didn't even surprise us. Alcoholics drink. That's what they do. He said, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That would surprise us. That's a surprise. But he said, you're going to drink, you know. He said, if you're an alcoholic, you're going to drink. You're going to drink no matter what. It's good stuff to know. And he did it kindly. I mean, he's not laying it to me. You already know, if you're new, that in these rooms, you hear stuff that you could not have said, but you know it. You have a cellular knowledge of it. It is like, oh my God. Yeah. And when he said, you're going to drink no matter what, I went, yeah, I do. I drink no matter what. He said, in fact, well-intended people in AA will tell you, don't drink no matter what, and you will drink no matter what. He said, that's just the way that it is. And as those hearts, he just let me have the simple dignity of the fact of the matter. That's all. And I didn't know what would happen to me. And I asked him what I would do. You just stay here today. Just stay here. Just stay here. Because I really understood that there was no hope for me. I got that day. And that was August 14th, 1966, and I never drank again after that. And I didn't know for 9 months that I wouldn't drink after that. It was such a surprise to me. I called that bail bondsman on my birthday. It was a surprise to him. He'd say, yeah, Clint, where are you? And you know what I love about AA? Because he thought I need to get bailed out of something. And he would say, where are you? And you know what is amazing? I knew the answer to the question. And I could say it. I love that.
One of the promises, I'm in the Pacific group in Los Angeles. One of the promises down there is you'll come to know your full name and address. You know? And some of us do. Not everybody, but a lot of us know where we live. I never drank again. 31 years. I didn't earn any of it. When, during that hideous night of the 14th of August, 1966, would I have earned any of it? What would I have done? Nothing. What did you do? Nothing, huh? We are taken to a place from which there is no return by human aid. Now we have two choices. One is to go on to the bitter end, trying to blot out our awareness of the horrible situation we're in. And the other is to accept spiritual help. Now that doesn't sound so good, does it? I mean, I don't want to crawl around on the linoleum floor in the shed over there, but I don't want to be sent to China either, you know? And so it was some time in Alcoholics Anonymous before I finally turned my attention to the fact that this is a spiritual program. We're drawn to it because we are seekers. We've tasted the honey. You can't sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and not once in a while be at peace in a way you've never been at peace. Whether it's from hearing somebody say something or from watching some guy take a cake that you know he can't stay sober, and there it is. You know that he has been profoundly touched. It's such an interesting thing to be aware of that. It was like Wilson had a very interesting experience when he was over in London as a young artillery officer. They took him to Winchester Cathedral. And he said in his story, Bill's story, much moved, I wandered outside. And you don't even know why he says that for 13 or 14 pages. And then he says in Towns Hospital, after having that white light experience, after having known that he was profoundly touched, his mind went back to the cathedral experience, an experience he had never forgotten. And he understood its implication. He said, for a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God and was humbly willing to have Him with me. And He came. He came. But soon the sense of His presence was blotted out by the clamor of worldly things, mostly those within myself. And I'm looking at that one day, because I always said, if I could have one of those white light experiences, hey, yeah. Wilson said, God comes to most men gradually, but His impact on me was sudden and profound. And I'm looking at His impact on me. On the 14th of August, 1966, I'm a drunk. And on the 15th, I am not. Now that's sudden and that's profound and that's moving right along. And I didn't do a damn thing to earn it. And so it gave me another handle on that. And what is my cathedral? My cathedral is these meetings. How many times have I been much moved and wandered outside? You sit in a meeting and you hear something or you see something or you're aware of something, and it's like it brings tears to your eyes. And then the meeting's over and you leave and you're on your way home and somebody irritates you. And it's gone. And how do we get that back? I'm a seeker. I want that. I want the power. I need power. There's some people that say, we're power seekers. Oh, we may be pretty subtle about it. We may be pretty cool. We're power seekers. There's people here in Auburn that don't care anything about power. None of them in this room, but there are people like that. We want power. That's why lack of power is such a dilemma for us. And we don't have any power. And we can't admit we don't have any power. And we wander in and out of these meetings. We've been struck sober. God's removed the obsession to drink. Our mind doesn't take us back there anymore. But we all know that we're not where we thought we would be. Because we've been trying to manage an unmanageable life. And it's tough sledding. That's why I was glad that John read that part of the book that he does. It's in the middle of a chapter called We Agnostics, which I never read for a long time because I didn't think I was agnostic. I think I'm a believer. So it might as well have been titled We Canadians, you know, it just didn't apply to me. And that's an amazing chapter because in it is everything that we need to get to a place where we see that it's possible that I can have a relationship with God, one that meets my needs, a personally satisfactory relationship with God. Isn't that something? I mean, and Wilson tells you a lot about it. He sets his question up on page 45. Where and how are we to find this power? And then on page 55 he says, finally answers the question, doesn't even tell you he's answering the question. Wilson is a tricky kind of a writer, but then anybody that can say the goose hung high is a tricky guy, I think. Wilson, what does that mean, man? The goose hung high. 55, he says, the power is inside us. The great reality is deep within. You know how you find it? Search fearlessly. Yeah. Yeah. And why wouldn't we? I mean, it's portable. And then the question comes to be, is there a place inside me where God is, where I can go? And then he says in the last sentence of that marvelous chapter, he says, God will disclose himself to you if you search for him. And what do we get? A new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction. That's all I ever wanted. That's all I ever wanted. That's the deal. And he promises us that. New power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. And so, along the way, after much searching and much travail and much hopelessness and much accompanied by a deep sense that I can never have this thing, I return to the place where it is, and that is the book of Alcoholics. For me, it is. And I came to a place where I found that power by absolutely following the directions in the book. Not just reading them. Somebody told me that my approach to the steps was pretty colorful because I'm like a guy that wants a chocolate cake, and so I go out and I buy a box of cake mix and I read the directions on the side and then I say, where the hell is my cake? I read the directions. Oh, I'll read them again. Okay. Oh, I'll memorize them. Good, you do that. We'll get a group of guys together and read them together. Perfect. We'll take turns. We'll bring a guy in that can speak French. He'll read them in French. Jesus, that'll bring a cheer to your eye, won't it? But there's no cake. And that's exactly the way I approached it. And so they said, you know what, the thing you want to do is just test it. You're the lab rat. These guys make a lot of wild statements in the book about what they did and the results they got. Why don't you assume that everything they said is true? Why don't you assume that it applies to you today? Why don't you assume that you could do exactly what they said they did, and if they're lying to you, you'll know it? And what do you got to lose? I mean, you can spend the rest of your life becoming the person you really want to be or defending who you are. Oh, these guys were rude with me. And I started. It's an amazing thing to discover it's all about power, that I don't have any. I got to get that at step one. I come to see that there is a power greater than me that will take me to sanity. I got to define sanity. I got to define the power. At three, I turn my will and my life over that power. At four, I begin to look at all of the goofy ways I've tried to get power for myself. I mean, why else would Wilson say, start with your resentments? Who do I resent? I resent people that seem to be more powerful than me. Who do I fear? There's a fear inventory. I fear people that are more powerful, or seem to be. What about that sex inventory? Well, isn't that the way that I've tried to get power out of a situation that's not a legitimate source of power? Yeah. It's all about power. And when I see that and the futility of it and all of the ways I tried to get power and all of the people I hurt and all of the character defects and all of the old ideas, after reading that to somebody, all of it, I've got a different look at it. And all I have to do is make a list of that stuff I don't want anymore and be willing to let it go and ask Him to take it. And He does that. When I was at step seven, it's funny, I was up here and there was a little conference over in Coloma some years ago. And a gal named Joyce from Reno was speaking. She knocked me out because she talked about wanting to get over her fear of heights. She was 10 years sober, and she took skydiving lessons to get over her fear of heights. Yeah, and came time for her to solo out of the airplane at the drop zone. She's at 3,500 feet. Her husband's in the drop zone, her daughters, the women she sponsored. Her ex-husband is there. I don't know why he was there, but he was there. I'm listening to this story. I mean, I'm really captured by this story. And her ex-husband was in it. Anyway, the chute didn't open right. And you got, since she's telling the story, that she lived through it. But it was a mess. She spent 18 months in a hospital, in her words, learning how to urinate again. And scarred up and thrashed. Her husband left her. Her ex-husband, the AA guy, came back into her life as a friend. 6 months go by, he's sitting in her room in the hospital or the extended care, whatever. And they're talking. They're hanging. And he finally said, let me ask you something. Joyce, he said, why did you do that? She said, you mean the... He said, yeah, what was that about? What? She said, I was just trying to get over my fear of heights. And he started to laugh. And she said, what are you laughing at? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. I went, oh my God. I've been jumping out of airplanes all my sobriety. All we have to do is ask. We ask for this gift. Some of us know exactly how we ask for it. Others don't. Others don't think it was a prayer. To beg for sobriety? No. But to beg for being out of the mess I'm in and really know that I'm toast? I don't know what prayer I said that night before I was given the gift of sobriety, but I said a prayer. Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? That's a prayer. We don't think of it that way because it's profane and angry. God is not put off by that. He honors the slightest turn in His direction. And He's not mad. Isn't that amazing? He's not mad. All He is love. God's love, and He works through people. Which brings me back to this thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And to you that are new, we're so glad you're here because we love you. And there's so much healing around that. It's not your healing, it's our healing. C See, God is love and He works through people and He is loving you through us. God loves me through my wife. God loves my job in that relationship is to live my life in such a way that God can love my wife through me. And the weird thing about AA, which is now 63 years of age as of the 10th of this month, is this. If you are new and you stick around here, somebody newer than you is going to come and sit down beside you, and you're going to find yourself loving that person, and your own healing will begin. And for 63 years now, we've called that Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.